Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Ellefson of the Digital Education Podcast, where I get the opportunity to talk with educators, innovators, people who are interested in making teaching and learning better, more efficient, more effective, and I think more interesting most of the time. I've been blessed to have many of these conversations now over the last year, and today I'm with Danish Karani. Danish is the chief designer at Karani. He's been an instructor at Harvard. He's now a lecturer at Stanford. I did like this description that I found online. Well, he's an American architect building environments to improve the human condition. Danish, I'm just going to jump right into it. As I recently read an article that linked traditional, you know, school buildings to prisons, and that, you know, kind of post-World War II and then the mass growth of schools that, you know, they just used kind of similar designs and similar principles that they used in prisons. Now, I don't know architectural history all that well. I'm wondering, first off, if that's an accurate statement. And if so, like, how do we begin to think differently about these facilities and these spaces that we have?
Yeah, I'd say that is accurate, Eric, to some degree. Not all schools, you're obviously going to have outliers and nonconformists, but for the vast majority of schools that were built in that era, there are certainly striking resemblances to prisons. Even thinking back to where I went to high school, of course, there's the resemblance of just the materials palette. They're cold, hard, impenetrable materials. You've got this masonry block, which is, of course, economical. And the economics, even if you look at it from that standpoint, you know, we're not pouring money into prisons to make them comfortable, welcoming places, right? The economics dictate that these should be built quickly, cheaply, with no care for the human being in that place. And if you look at the economics of schools of that era, there was also a similar approach. It was, of course, mass standardization. You know, how can we do this in the most affordable, economical way possible and just churning out these schools? So, of course, from that standpoint, you know, that leads you to a certain palette of materials. You know, the materials were impenetrable because they wanted to feel like you can't mess with this place. This is a fortress. Speaking of prisons, and then, you know, of course, that logic carries over when you have those same materials in schools. Of course, you also have bland palettes, a lot of thought to, you know, what makes a good environment in schools. And so you ended up painting a lot of hallways and all this, you know, masonry block, beige and grays and off-whites, and it just starts to look like prisons. But even if we think about the planning of the schools, if you look at campus layouts, I'm thinking back to where I went to high school, we had a two-story building with two interior square courtyards. You couldn't access the courtyards from the second story. You just had windows looking onto it. And from the first floor, you could access just through a few doors. And, you know, that was it. You had very specific entry and exit points, very specific access points. It was easier to control flow. And so, of course, that gets correlated to, well, in prison, you have these, you know, recess spaces or you know, physical activity spaces that are really interior. They're surrounded on all four sides, got a guard tower. So it does become about surveillance and control. And, you know, if you look at schools today, a lot of them are these double-loaded corridors, very reminiscent of, you know, if you're a warden and you're walking down the hallways of a prison and you've got cells on both sides, you know, I think there's a reason that educators today often joke about cells and bells. And, you know, where does that come from? Well, of course, that comes from prison logic. And so, you know, you've got these physical layouts, these floor plans that are reminiscent of prisons as well. And again, look at schools today. We force kids to carry a hall pass in some schools just to go to the restroom. So to do this bodily function that is absolutely necessary for us as a creature, as an organism on this planet to live and survive, we're saying, you know what, you're going to have to wait for me, or I'm going to have to give you a hall pass, and where everyone's going to know exactly where you're going, because we don't trust you to walk 100 feet down the hall to, you know, relieve yourself and then come back. We don't trust you to do that. And so, you know, I think things like that, if you look at schools, you know, we've been designing schools in New York City, obviously, you know, the schools are now, as you enter, they've got metal detectors. So of course the similarities to prisons is absolutely there. And I think it's justified. And, you know, again, whether it's for economics, or whether it's for how we're considering the users, the occupants of the space, or in fact not considering them, they have, for a large part, ended up looking very similar.
So let me ask you this question. I'm going to come back to one question about safety and security later, but I think, you know, question I've been wondering about, and especially for you, you've worked all over the country, you've been involved with schools around the world now. Where do you go to get creativity, or what suggestions would you have to get people out of what has become so much of the norm? And I think there is a desire, and I've been around you when you've spoke to, you know, to educators who desire to do things different and to think differently about this. But where do you go for inspiration, creativity, and just the opportunity to think outside the norm? And what suggestions would you give for educators too?
I think in any field, Eric, there's a risk of the professionals in that field getting too self-referential. What I mean by that, and of course this happens in architecture, where architects look at the work of other architects and they mimic and imitate the work of other architects and those ideas, and in a way it perpetuates what's already happening. And this happens in education as well. Schools look at what other schools are doing, they find best practices, and sometimes they don't even question whether those practices are working or if they truly are best practices. They just look at practices and models and copy and imitate. And so, of course, when you have this self-referential, you know, operation, this way of operating, then you're going to get more or less the same thing over and over, and you'll have slight variations. And similar to evolution, it's an extremely slow process at that point to really have change and then weed out, you know, what's working and what's not working. Again, same with evolution. It takes a long time to do that weeding out process. So, you know, for us, we're looking outside of schools. So when we want to design schools and we're thinking about, you know, how do we make them special? How do we make them better? How do we make them you know, less like the schools as we just talked about that look like prisons and look like other schools. So for example, comfort is obviously a big thing. People learn better when they're more comfortable, whether it's temperature or lighting or just a vibe or feeling they get from the atmosphere, or physically, if they're just more comfortable, they're going to learn better. That's proven. There's no debating that. And so what are places that we have historically for generations thought about making comfortable? Well, it's our homes. So we look to the home a lot. Now, schools also need to be places that are fun. So what are places that are fun? We think about playgrounds. You know, is one example of a place that we can learn something about them being fun. Schools also, we hear educators talking about, well, you know, we want our children to have a sense of wonder and discovery. You know, but for us, that we start to think about not a physical place, but we even think about events or moments in our lives. So you start to think about when you go on vacation and you travel to a foreign place and you are in awe and you're discovering the new place, the new culture, the people. How do you recreate those types of feelings, those types of experiences in schools? And so for us, it's really about looking outside of that, breaking away from this, you know, this self-referential way of operating, which plagues so many people in the profession, both architecture and education. And so it's a constant, you know, reminder to ourselves at the beginning of every project. Okay, now it's almost, you know, forget everything that we've done in the past, forget what others have done. Let's start from a clean slate and let's look and be observers of what does this school really asking for? What do they need? And, you know, where might we find something analogous to that? Where might we find an industry, an event, a place, something in the world, a product that has achieved that, that has met those goals, that, that might speak to this? So, for example, when we were designing the Riverbend School in India, you know, we turned to sociology and anthropology. So we knew that the school cared about student happiness, and they wanted this to be a place where students were able to learn how to be happy and cultivate this inner happiness that lasted them for the rest of their lives. And so we turned to a sociological study by Harvard. It was the longest study in the world, 80-year study that followed hundreds of individuals and concluded that happiness is not a function of your job or your wealth or your fame, but in fact, happiness is directly correlated to your personal relationships and how strong those relationships are. So we said, okay, so we know relationships really matter. Now, who can teach us about relationships? And we actually found anthropological studies that the relationships are strongest in villages. So we ended up studying the urban planning of villages to help design our campus. And so it might seem a bit roundabout. It's how would you have ever gotten to that point? How would you ever start and say, okay, well, we're going to turn to villages to design this school? And in fact, some people may say, oh, we want our school to be like a village, but that might be more akin to biomimicry, where we're just copying something without really knowing why. We know it works out in nature. And for us, you know, often when we see examples of biomimicry, that's usually what it is. Oh, we're going to design this place to be like a tree. Well, do we really understand how the tree works and how those functions of a tree and everything about it, from its root system to the capillaries and in the leaves, like, do we understand how that works and how that can translate over to what we're trying to achieve? So for us, you know, for the India school, the Riverbend school, we ended up doing quite a bit of research, and it led us down this path of sociological studies, anthropological studies. And so, again, you know, for us, it's really step back. Let's try to have a clean slate about this and not get too caught up in what other architects and what other schools have done in the past.
So this is perfect, and it's great because, I mean, you know, reading that study about relationships and the interaction of relationships, and one of the things that I've been, I guess, growing in my, you know, trying to have an impact on, but then just growing in my concern, and it is juxtaposed with what you say about us as adults, you know, being careful about designing things for ourselves. Like, how in this process, or in your growth process, the biggest, you know, one of the biggest things I'm concerned about, or growing in my concern about, is just the relationships between the adults in schools, the health and well-being of teachers and educators, and just the interactions. And a lot of these schools are unhealthy places to even work, or just aren't good at even cultivating those relationships like you talk about. Like, what design elements have you discovered that help educators move into, in some ways, less of the ownership of the space, but more so in the involvement and the well-being and the enjoyment of the space?
Well, I think it really goes back to your position on who you're designing for. So we hear many schools say we're student-centric. And I don't think that's wrong. On the other hand, what if schools said we're people-centric? So we're not just thinking about students, but we're also thinking about the adults and the educators in the building. So for us, the thought is, if you nurture the educators, they in turn are going to nurture their students. as an administration, if you show the educators that you care about them, that's going to have a trickle-down effect, and they're going to care about someone, and that someone's going to be their students. And so a lot of times in schools, it's the simplest things. I mean, we can go back to Maslow. It's the basic needs that often are ignored for the adults in the building. So do they have healthy snacks and coffee and water and a place to take a breather and just get away from people? I mean, they have such demanding jobs. Do we give them a place where they can just take a few minutes to have some alone time and space? How many schools can say that they actually have places like that on campus where educators can go, or that they actually give educators enough time to do that? Because at the end of the day, we want these educators to perform at their best. Are we actually thinking about what makes an educator perform at their best? Or are we just saying, we're going to hire competent educators, give them a really demanding workload, throw them in a classroom that's overcrowded, and then expect them to do their best? So, you know, for us, it's, of course, it starts with these basic needs, but then you also have to think about, you know, as humans, we're social creatures. These educators also deserve a place to socialize. You know, Teacher's Lounge, for example, is a great example of that space. Now, too often in schools, that's, you know, it's maybe a closet that was converted, or just a room where there was no investment in that room at all. It's very much an afterthought. I'll give you one example. When we designed the Khan Lab School in California, we placed the teacher's lounge at the crossroads of the lower school, the middle school, and the upper school. So the teacher's lounge actually had access from those three schools plus the lobby. So you could get to the teacher's lounge from four sides. And what it did is, because of that convenience, teachers actually were able to come into the space frequently throughout the day when they needed to grab a snack, when they needed a hot desk to just stop somewhere, check a few emails, do a bit of work, when they needed to just rest their head on a couch for a few minutes and slow down, when they needed to collaborate with someone and work with someone. So that strategic placement, first of all, where we are actually signaling to you that we want you to use this space because we've made it easy for you to get there. Then, you know, making an investment in that space, making sure that it's full of healthy, you know, fruits and snacks and drinks and coffee and water, and has adequate lighting, even thinking about the light color, the temperature, right? So often, you know, we walk into teachers' lounges and they're sitting under these fluorescent lights, and it's just a very bleak, cold place. So even thinking about the lighting temperature, having a bit more warm incandescent lighting that's reminiscent of our homes, again, going back to this idea of comfort. These are things that are signaling something to teachers, whether you know, it's, you know, whether it's explicit or not, teachers are taking something away from this space mentally. And so, you know, we've seen that, of course, when you design with not just students, but also the educators in mind, you know, it really does curb attrition, and retention rates are increased for your educators. And the simplest things, you know, giving them good learning environments. So even thinking about, obviously, designing good classrooms, that not only does wonders for students, it also does wonders for teachers. We've had teachers that have used our classroom prototypes in Denver Public Schools that have said, you know, these classrooms enable me to do things and teach in ways that I wish, you know, I could have been doing for years now, that, you know, I just didn't have the ability to do this before. And, you know, teachers are proud of their craft. And when they're able to do something meaningful, when they're able to do something well, you know, that gives obviously a sense of fulfillment like it would in anyone's job. And so it's really about empowering and enabling and showing teachers that you care about them and thinking about how do we get our educators to perform at their highest level.
So let me ask you a final question, because I don't want to maybe take the skeptics route, right, where they're, you know, and where I've heard them, you know, ask about, you know, costs, like this got to be way too expensive, or even security, you know, you can't do this because of security. And maybe if you want to touch on those, because I've heard you talk about both of those in the past, but my question is really, is you encourage people or come across educators or, you know, innovative leaders at schools, like what's a great place just to get started, to begin to incubate some of this change and foster some of this, you know, as maybe then there is even a larger look at, you know, facility redesign. Like, where do you get started with some of this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll quickly touch, you mentioned the safety issue, and, you know, we've had multiple conversations about this before with other groups as well. And, you know, this idea back to the prisons that, well, schools are designed this way. You know, they were very monolithic and hermetic places. We were talking about, this was in the civil rights era that everyone also considered like urban ills. We wanted to protect our kids from the big bad streets outside. And, you know, even in recent two decades, the amount of tragic shootings and violent incidents we've had in schools in America. And of course, it almost makes people want to climb deeper into that hole and wall themselves off more as schools. And I actually say we need to do the opposite. And I'll be quick about this, but, you know, there was a seminal book published in the 1960s by Jane Jacobs. She's an urban planner. Called The Death and Life of Great American Cities. And she talked about why certain cities flourish and why others don't. She also talked about safety in that. And one of the key factors about safety, and she was talking about urban areas like New York City, one of the key factors about safety was eyes on the street. And what that meant was the more people there are walking on the streets, the safer you feel. Why is that? Because there are eyes around. So the eyes on the street made you feel safe. The sense of other people are here. So if something happens, other people are watching. And so things are less likely to happen. So in that same vein, I say that schools, in fact, could benefit from not keeping outsiders off of campus, but in fact, inviting more adults to be on campus. Invite more community members, more parents, more professionals, more experts, more people, bring that social capital onto campus, give your students access to that social capital and that intellectual capital, bring that onto campus. We've seen schools do amazingly well with intergenerational learning where they brought, you know, seniors onto campus. But the more eyes you have on campus, the safer it's going to be. And I think the more we head towards these fortress-like campuses that are keeping people off and become less urban and turn their backs to the street and to their community, you know, the more problems we're going to have. So just that's about safety. In terms of where to start, Eric, I think, you know, what we've seen from a lot of schools is something as simple as start with one or two prototypes, right? Pick one or two rooms in your school or in your district and let's turn those into exceptional learning environments where we can see as a school or as a district, we can see, you know, how our students and teachers are responding, get their feedback, understand from teachers, you know, how does this further enable any new curriculum objectives? You know, some schools are coming at it with a completely new school model. Could be great for schools like that. And also use those prototype spaces for PD, for professional development. use them to train other teachers from the school or the district, get everyone comfortable, start building that level of comfort. Because of course, for a lot of teachers and students, these are very different than the environments they're used to. And luckily, students are very adaptable, and students, you know, they'll go with the flow with anything. And in fact, we've seen how thrilled they are with these new environments. It's usually the teachers that we have to sort of break out of the practices that they're used to. And you know, they're so overly regulated most of the time that for them, when they do get a sense of freedom or something different, you know, they're going to dip their toe in the water first. But once they really get in, they end up making the most of these spaces. So I say, you know, start with the prototype is one way to go about it. Another is to just get a concept design. So work with us, you know, let's develop a concept design. A lot of schools, they've been able to use these concept designs to, you know, go on capital campaigns and start that way. But the other thing that it does is working with an architect that understands education. So what I mean by that is, you know, if you want to talk to us about ed tech, you want to talk about timetables, individualized learning plans, whatever it might be, we're able to have that conversation with you. We can talk about pedagogy and understand what you're saying. We can go through different school models and know what the differences are between them. When you have an architect that can work with you that really understands education, then they're also provoking you, and they're hopefully forcing you to really think about, you know, what is my value proposition? If we're thinking in business terms, you know, what makes my school unique? What is unique and different and special about this place of education? How are we thinking about nurturing these students? What do we want by the time our kids graduate? You know, these are questions that are very simple questions, but how many people across the school would really be aligned if we asked them individually? So, you know, it forces schools to really step back and answer these fundamental questions and get on the same page, and then start to imagine, what does that look like in physical form? So I think those are, Eric, two ways that schools can get started. Of course, you know, I'm happy to talk to any of the schools that are listening if they want to get in touch, and we can start to brainstorm other ways that, you know, they can, in essence, dip their toe in the water and start to test out, you know, what modern learning environments can do for them and their people.
So what would be the best way, and I'll put it up online too, is what's the best way to connect with you?
Just drop me an email. You can email our team at info@Kurani.us. info@Kurani.us would be the best way. Of course, they can check out, you know, plenty of case studies and articles and blog posts and resources on our website at Kurani.us, but that would be the best way.
Danish, I really appreciate your time, and thank you for sharing this expertise. And I really do. I mean, it's always exciting to me to talk with you and to reignite even my own thinking about my workspace and what I have control over and what I can impact, just even in my work, but then also my work with students. So I really appreciate your time, and thanks for your expertise.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Eric. Keep up the good work.